You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry on KTAH 101.9 FM Radio Tacoma. I am your host, David Gilmore, and we are very, very pleased to have Kathleen Flinnikin with us today, who has experienced a poetic life as the Poet Laureate of the State of Washington back in 2012 to 2014. And though she had a former career as a civil engineer, some years, I don't quite know how many that is, she has been definitely active in poetry for some time and has several works to her credit and many prestigious rewards for them. The early book that I have is Famous from 2006. Another, that's from the University of Nebraska Press. Another, Plume, from the University of Washington Press, 2012. And Post-Romantic, which is fairly new, 2020, that has also received notices and awards. Well, there's other books, I'm sure, to come from Kathleen, because we've got some new poems to hear today, and we're very delighted to have you, Kathleen. You grew up in the heavily freighted landscape of the Tri-Cities in Washington State. That means a sort of dire history of the mid-20th century, but it's still with us. But I really do wish you to say whatever you'd like about your past, and I know your poems really do bring forth some of your memories of that time. So we'll have a chance to hear those in verse. Is it a good time, renaissance for poetry?
Well, I do think there is a renewed interest in poetry in our country, which is very gratifying. I was on a Zoom conference call two weeks ago that was Ukraine poets and their translators featured, and there were 850 people in the meeting watching the Ukrainian poets read, and that just got around. That was just word of mouth, and so I think people in hard times really find comfort in poetry and they rediscover it. I also think that there's a renaissance in the way we are allowing in new voices, not just the traditional voices sort of from power, but there's this self-made quality to a lot of the poets that are publishing right now. And I think people are seeing themselves in poems in ways they haven't in the past. And I very much identify with that, because I didn't discover poetry until I was in my 30s. I mean, I read poems in school, and I had a friend who was a poet, and I was a good listener for her poems. But it wasn't until I started checking out books from the library and I actually finally found a woman who was writing about washing, you know, doing laundry. And I was in the middle of piles of laundry myself that I realized, oh, I can write poems. I can write poems about my own life. So that was an exciting discovery for me. So, yeah, I do think there is a renaissance going on.
Good. I hope there will continue to be, too. We're going to start out with something rather light and perhaps something ironic in its way. Would you please start out by reading some graphology?
Okay, happily. This is from my first book, Famous. I was taking these little night classes when my kids were very small, just to kind of get out of the house. And I took one on graphology. And one of the things I remember her saying, the teacher saying, is that not only does your handwriting change when your life changes, but she believed that if you changed your handwriting, you could actually change your life. That's the premise behind this poem. Graphology. Your eyes lie on their backs. They look like twos. You lead a double life. Your V's are spread, about to fly away. Your O's threaten to tell on you. Your Y is very large. Y is ruining your life. I advise a smaller Y. Likewise, your C is wide open, and your G's tongue is thrusted, cupped, as though to taste something it's long resisted. Everywhere, too much mouth. Capitalize your A's to look like praying hands soon. Trim your tails. Space your words a safer distance apart. Some are mingled, confused, where they stop and start. Keep M's small and low, like fists. Slope your R's like a crone hoeing the ground. You leave footprints on the snowy page. I can see where you're going. Turn around.
Yes. Well, that takes us back to decades in your own poetry, but it certainly takes us back quite a way when people actually did more handwriting than scripting on screens.
I guess, and the opportunity for changing your life is less now that we don't have handwriting.
It may be like astrology, or it may be, we don't know. But that's very, very interesting one to begin with. But now we're going to go to something that takes us to a little bit darker mood. The sound of a train.
A lot of the poems in my collection, Famous, were written right after my parents died. So there's a lot of a grief, I think, in the poems. And so this poem was written during that period of sort of recovering. But I still find comfort in this poem. I think it still applies to me because, you know, this is 20 years later and I'm still thinking about them on a daily basis. And so I think this poem sort of still suits me. The sound of a train. I first heard it in the mornings. I'd scan the hibernating garden and sky, sure there were no tracks nearby. Then other hours, other trackless hillsides. Once along the leaf-blown lakeshore, I heard a train's wail, the very breath of grief. I turned and saw a flash like a stag in the trees before the dark scene stilled. Then I knew. My mother and father were aboard. My parents ride through the living world and watch for me. If I could find their tracks, I'd wait patiently, the way I used to at boarding gates with lop-eared flowers from the garden, hungry for stories of their holidays away. But the ghost train leaves no tracks. It never stops. Its stations are unknown to me. My parents can't disembark or catch my eye or say how good it is to be together again. Another whistle announces they are near, side by side, gazing out at the world. I listen to them passing by. What travelers they are.
So ghosts are important in several of your poems, but the train, there's something so lugubrious and yet comforting in a lugubrious way when you hear a distant train whistling in the night as it goes through a passage of the town or through the freight yards or what have you. Like a foghorn, quite a wonderful reminiscence there. I think we're going to find something of the same feeling in Rattlesnake Mountain. It is still not a very rosy picture that you're going to paint here.
So Rattlesnake Mountain is it's part of my collection Plume. And Plume is a book-length examination of my life growing up and living in Richland, Washington, which is next to the Hanford nuclear site. Hanford is the most contaminated waste site in our hemisphere. And it's the most expensive cleanup in the world. And I found when I was traveling around Washington State, I was not quite shocked, but I was disheartened to know how many people had never even heard of Hanford. And that's in our own backyard. And so one of my feelings about this book is that I want people to know this story. I want people not to forget that we still have to clean up Hanford. But it's also my hometown. And my hometown extends into the Hanford site. It was just part of our culture. So Rattlesnake Mountain is a kind of an introduction. It's one of the very earliest poems in the book. Rattlesnake Mountain. We claim it's the tallest treeless mountain in the world, which is only true if you behold it. Mistress of dust storms, wildfires, windswept and monochrome. And acknowledge we live exposed to the planets here, that the mountain's folds and shadows roll with stars, soft April greens and lupin, belying missile silos hidden in catacombs and the waste of 50 years of atomic bombs. Our families all came from elsewhere and regarded the desert as empty and ugly, which gave us permission to savage the land. The mountain, figure in repose, looked on as we buried what we buried at its hem. Desert turned vineyard, orchard, strip mall, houses in every shade of beige. This radioactive burial ground and the hills along its edge are the last unbroken stretch of shrub step remaining. I left the mountain half my life ago to live among trees, and now, an exile, I understand what beautiful ghost rises up in the distance in my dreams. Now I know this ruined place is sacred.
Mm-hmm. Was there contention about Rattlesnake Mountain by the Indian tribes who knew it as probably a sacred mountain?
It was a sacred site. They didn't have any voice in their land being taken away, nor did the farmers that were living there. Everyone had to vacate. They had about 3 weeks to do so, and late 1942, very early 1943, and they just had to leave the site for the war effort, and that's all they knew.
Bedroom community. Again, we go back into your past.
Yeah, this is another early poem in the collection. And in this poem, I'm introducing two very important characters. And one is Carolyn, who was my childhood friend. She lived just a few houses up the street. And her father. And her father is a central character because he died of a radiation illness in his late 50s, which sort of forced the issue for me. I had to accommodate the truth that he had died from the work he did at Hanford in the face of all the reassurances we'd had growing up that there was nothing unsafe going on there and everyone's health was just fine and no one had ever died. And so it caused me to have to rethink everything. And I guess you could say his death was the trigger for this whole collection. Bedroom community. We were all bedded down in our nightcaps, curtains drawn as swamp coolers and sprinklers hissed every brown summer hour, or in winter, sagebrush hardened in the cold. It was still dark as our fathers rose, dressed and boarded blue buses that pulled away, and men in milk trucks came collecting bottled urine from our doorsteps. Beyond the shelter belt of Russian olive trees, cargo trains shuffled past at 8 and 8, and the wide Columbia rolled by, silent with walleye and steelhead. We pulled up our covers while our overburdened fathers dragged home to fix a drink, and some of them grew sick. Carolyn, your father's marrow testified. Whistles from the train. The buses came, our fathers left. Oh, Carolyn, while the rest of us slept.
There is some lovely music in that one too. I really enjoy some of the assonance that you have put in there that broadens the lines. The cargo trains that shuffled past, they were wide, and a wide Columbia rolled by, silent with wall eye. Those really do give you a feeling of continuing the stream of the river. Very good. Very good. Yeah, and so Cold War, we go even into something that will, well, actually this one gave me such thoughts of really contemporary. We thought this was all gone, you know, shelters, nuclear problem. We thought this was past. And it comes zooming back to us in a short.
This really shades of World War II, these last months. Mm-hmm. This is, I think of this as kind of an older person telling a younger person what it was like to be alive during, you know, to be a baby boomer, or to be a of the generation of World War II, what it was like to live through the Cold War, and the way it kind of makes you sort of shaped our thinking. The Cold War. It will turn quaint soon enough. Bomb shelters already charm us, stuffed to their low ceilings with batteries, board games, and cans. Sardines are amusing, and pineapple rings for dessert. Old footage of duck and cover drills inspires us to be world-weary and ironic, to embrace the futile. Once we considered A-bombs big, then H-bombs exploded over the South Pacific. We can laugh now at Khrushchev and his shoe, beauty queens in radiation suits. I'd wake bolt upright in my bed, afraid of a flash to come. I'd buy books and extra spaghetti to provide for our last days and pray that our end be painless. I wasn't even that young. I remember the red phone and missile codes, how every movie hinged on a clock ticking down. We called it the arms race, and there were two sides. It was simple.
Yes, it's as though you had written this idea. It was simple. Now we have how many sides? There are so many, many sides in the global complexity. Yeah. Very, very, very good that you chose that one. Thank you for reading that one. And now, of course, post-romantic, not getting terribly light in feeling at times, even in your post-romantic course.
Well, you didn't catch the jokes in the Cold War poem. there's lightness in there. you just have to look a little harder.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, this is for my husband. Karaoke. Do something, you're his wife, somebody begs me, when you're a couple of verses in. But wasn't everybody forced to take a turn? I watch you center stage where you never, ever want to be, stunned in the revolving red lights of Jimi Hendrix. Are you experienced? A song we now know has no melody or end. Laughing is wrong. What else is there? Your boss records the crime on his iPhone. It's suddenly clear how much effort goes into just being, just holding ourselves still. Our bizarre niceties and party store lays, the saucy meatball you stabbed, then abandoned on a plastic plate. A few with good manners pay no attention and pore over the list of has-been anthems. How did we get this far into a foreign century, this many levels down into middle age? Outside the bar, it's night. We've got to find our car in the frigging cold and make conversation all the way home. I won't be able to say, I wanted to wrap you in a blanket like the survivor of a 5-alarm fire. And who cares if you were naked?
Yes. Yes. I think that's good. You also bring in one of Seattle's icons, Jimi Hendrix, there.
Yeah.
Are You Experienced? And of course, a song we now know has no melody nor end.
It was a very poor choice. A lot of the poems in post-romantic are marriage poems. That's kind of a central spine for the collection. So,
right. Well, we'll go back to some old-fashioned folk here, the Maiden Ladies.
Maiden Ladies. Okay, so this is again, sort of staking my territory as a person of a certain age, and I'm trying to hang on to some of those early memories that seem to have gone away, that those things just don't exist anymore. And one of those is an expression that I remember so much from my childhood is maiden ladies. My mother had all these maiden lady friends from her home. They were friends of my grandmother's. And when we went back to her hometown, we would always visit the maiden ladies. And so I wanted to write a poem for them. And in the background too, I think just before I had written this, I was reading Marianne Moore's book of her letters. And her letters are fantastic. Her correspondence is just incredible. And so she is such an odd maiden lady that there are shades of Marianne Moore in here too. Maiden ladies. They were plentiful back then, black hatted in museums of natural history, staring into yellow dioramas of basilisks, swaying so as not to be confused for displays. They paid their dimes on rainy afternoons to sit with 10-year-old boys watching films about Brazilian snakes and Madagascan bats, and could be counted on to inform shop clerks of shameful declines in quality, to order special extra plain undergarments, unappetizing cuts of meat, and okra tablets, to jam their feet into witches' shoes that made their ankles swell. Then hats went out of style. Shop clerks started talking back, and the maiden ladies died. They're not even in museums.
Yes, the hats went out of style, and the shop clerks started talking back. That really does. There's a demarcation there in eras, yeah. Right? Well, now we're still going back away with a Charlie Brown Christmas in the title. That does bring back bygone era. Poem ending with lines from A Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yes. This poem takes place right after my parents both died and my brothers and I were tasked with clearing out their house. And it's such a difficult, sentimental time, and yet you also have to be ruthless because you're just getting rid of so much stuff. It's a very strange experience.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Poem ending with lines from A Charlie Brown Christmas. I enter my childhood home, a newly minted 40-year-old orphan, desiring everything, rifling through the kitchen junk drawer and the auxiliary rubber band drawer, and the third drawer full of twist ties and styrofoam meat trays. I want, like a robber, the silverware and the encyclopedia set. I want my mother's sense of her own beauty. I want the sound of the house settling at night. I'm the baby of the family. I want my brothers to love me more than I deserve. I'm taking the sugar and creamer engraved with Shakespeare. To thine own self be true, and actions speak louder than words. I want the prizes at the bottom of every box of cereal ever eaten here. Before we sell the house with its dear ghosts and take our turn growing old, I insist on one last game of risk. And this time I will not cry and will demonstrate strategy. All I want is what I have coming to me. All I want is my fair share.
Oh, I thought you were going to really emphasize those lines where I want these things. Every box of cereal that's ever been eaten here, I want those little trinkets. Yeah. Now, Stephen Dobbins, I don't know how many know Stephen Dobbins' poetry, but this one goes from a line of his verse.
Yes. Yeah. This is a poem I wrote with a friend, and it's very interesting. We just started with the first line from one of Stephen Dobbins' poems. So his line is, as a stone has a sense of its hardness. And it's a really interesting exercise to see where you can go just based on a line. And this has changed quite a bit over the years as I've worked on it. But that is the genesis of the poem. From a line by Stephen Dobbins. As a stone has a sense of its hardness, so a man senses the hardness of the mountain blocking his light. When he strikes the mountain with his mind, he hears a clang like boxcars bumping in the rail yard at night. He guards against shapeliness, but can't stop his curtains from fluttering in the breeze. Brushes the fat cheek of an apple with his thumb and blames his thumb. The mountain is hard, even in a coat of quieting snow. A man makes boot prints to the orchard, woods, field, shed, and back to the house. They'll turn to ice before they melt.
Now my brain says to my heart, your traveling family influenced you here.
So this was inspired by a Yusuf Kumanyaka poem called The Brain to the Heart. So I've borrowed that idea of my brain having a conversation with my heart, a kind of, you know, heart to heart, you might say, brain to heart, and revealing the character of both. So in this poem, the brain is the traveler and the heart is the hoarder. My brain says to my heart, I'm the traveler in the family while you cram the house like one of those hoarders on TV, stumbling between stacks of pancake mix and Christmas shit still in tags that leave no place to sleep but the car. So here we go. The doors thunk closed on a clean, so quiet our ears begin to ring. The dials light up when I turn the key. I say, time to toss a match and gun the engine. You cry and crane your neck. Go back.
Torn. They're torn. No, let's go back. I left stuff. The quiet one. Now, this one goes into surgical matters and thoughts of the body, sensuality. And yes, this is going to be very interesting to hear.
Yeah, I had breast cancer a couple of years ago, and I had a mastectomy. So I've written a number of poems that have helped me heal from that, and I felt that was extremely important to my coming to terms with my illness and with my recovery. So this is one of those poems. One of the things that happens after you lose the breast is you lose the feeling. Even if you have a reconstructed breast, you can't feel it. So that was something that I had been warned in advance and had to sort of adjust to.
Yes.
Quiet one. When the breast is taken, what remains is not unfeeling, but unfelt, unable to speak. Long marriage has taught me silence can be a reply, so touch can be like conversation I'm learning to live without. What if I'd lost my breast when I was still picking fights and throwing myself on the bed, demanding, tell me, like a reckless driver in the dark, bearing down on a hapless car with failing lights. It would have been a tragedy then. Silence strikes me now as the truest answer from what's missing. I can cup the silence in my hand and feel its warmth the way anybody touching me could.
Yes, a very personal and sensitive poem. Silence appears very, very important, in important ways in this one.
Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you.
The language of making is the last of your new poems. We have here four new poems that we've been hearing three of already. Well, the language of making, you're making something with all of your poems.
Yeah.
And this is the language of making, which, of course, is a pun on poem because it is a made thing, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. I actually wrote this poem for a broadside that was made for a papermaking group. They make paper, and then there's a beautiful letterpress printer in Tacoma who she did the layout of the poem, and mm-hmm. that's sort of the source of the poem, and I've worked on it since. So it really was about making something physical, but also I don't think of it as so much as writing a poem as making a poem. I think it really is a made thing. So it sort of feeds into that idea as well. The language of making. The girl you were shuts herself in the hall closet. A high window shines like a square moon above an atmosphere of coats and scarves. She's not hiding from the summer day. She's chosen this tiny country with its stand of leaning umbrellas, its interior weather of galoshes and gloves. Its citizens ask in their language, "What do you make of this square of old carpet?" And she answers with a sleigh, a rooftop, a field with a creek running through. "Will you fly our flag?" She pulls on her father's red silk scarf and brushes it across her knees like music. When you return to that country, the language will come back to you.
A country in a closeted country. It makes you think about the country you're in.
Yeah.
And what is in it when it's that tiny. But "Will you fly our flag" is quoted as though someone's actually asking that question. And I often think that's an interesting idea in anybody's life. What does it take to get a flag and to fly it? You're really showing your colors when you do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's been such a popular thing in recent years in the horrendous 21st century of wars to know how to fly the flag.
Mm-hmm.
But is this the American flag you're thinking of here?
No, I was thinking of the flag of my father's red silk scarf.
All right. So that's what you're going. Okay.
You know, I think poems, they sometimes say things after the fact that you didn't consider. And I think it's better that way. I think it's easier when you just say the thing or remember the image you want to remember. And then sometimes meaning lays itself over the top of it. And that's a wonderful thing. But I don't think it can be sort of deadly to try to say something. I think that's very hard to pull off. So I'm all for just finding that image you can't shirk off. I just kept thinking about my dad's scarf in that mm-hmm. closet. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes, there's a very sensitive playing with it. It's aesthetic there, pulling the father's red scarf and brushes it across the knees like music. Yeah, that's a very aesthetic moment that you have there. But when you return to that country, the language will come back to you. So listeners who have enjoyed Kathleen Flanagan Day, get back to that country. Get back to the language. It'll come. And that was such wonderful readings. What a very good choice of sequence, Kathleen. I think you really put it together beautifully.
Thank
you for being on Sound Poetry with us.
Thank you, David. It's been a delight. I appreciate it so much.
Thanks a lot. Take care now.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
This is Sound Poetry. I'm your host, David Gilmore, and we have been listening to the verse of Memoir of Moments of Grief, and some lovely verse by a former poet laureate of our state of Washington, Kathleen Flanagan.